Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Winder, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And as always, I have a question for you. How well do you know Islam? There are very few religions that create such hostile fear as Islam. And like all religions, when we see the fundamentalist side, we see the absolute worst of it. In today's podcast and post, we continue our One World series with a look at Islam and discover that its hostility has always been the case, but it doesn't need to be. Join me now as we see Islam within the tale of two brothers and discover that Muhammad's call to total submission may not be something to fear. Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for coming back to yet another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. My name is Kevin Winder. I'm your host, and I like to serve the world as an online pastor, author, and uncoach, among many other things that I do, just like you. I say that every time because it's true. And folks, if you're joining us today, perhaps for the first time, I want to welcome you to the podcast. I also want to say welcome to this series. We find ourselves within a series called One World. It's a look at the world's religions through a lens that is potentially, well, not potentially, but is actually very transformative. You see, our modern world is kind of tired of religion. Most people adopt a scientific perspective that sees religion as this thing that we no longer need for our lives. Parents and grandparents who hold on to religious traditions are seeing their younger children and grandchildren moving away further and further from the faith that they grew up with. What's this all about? As we move into systems of faith, oftentimes we get into competitions about who's right, who has the better religion, whose God is bigger, who, you know, and it just becomes a debate and ultimately a war. And this is actually not any progress at all from thousands of years ago. And I think we can do better. But in order to do so, we have to look at this through a particular lens that is a long view. This is a long game. I've said that before. I've had a lot of conversations with many of you, and this is something that really does come up in your thinking, in your life, but you can't give time to studying the world's religions. You can't really afford the bandwidth of energy and thought that it's going to take to get your head around the whole thing. And like most people, you just settle with the one you grew up with or with none at all, lump everything together in a convenient package and say it's not relevant, it's not important. What I'm here to do today is, and through this series, is awaken you to a bigger story, awaken you to something that it bubbles through each and every world system. And so we started with science, we moved on to Judaism, and today we come to the religion of Islam. And it is our fourth chapter in the series. It's called One World Four, Islam as the Older Brother. And it's podcast number 247, Islam as the Older Brother. Now, folks, as we kind of dive into these, you need to know that I'm not breaking down each religion and trying to do a compare and contrast. That's been done a million times before, and basically the team you're on now is the team you'll be on afterwards. You will look at the differences and probably diminish those differences and somehow convince yourself that what you believe is better. And that's true for those who have ignored religion altogether. That's why I started with science. The scientific worldview is a system of faith. It is a religion. And you, whether you realize it or not, look down on those who hold to traditional faith systems. I'm not going to give you the ins and outs of the religious practice. I'm not going to debate doctrine. I'm not going to give an apologetic. Although this whole thing is an apologetic, it's done in a way that when you get to the last edition of this, I hope all of these pieces can stitch together into a new framework into which you can make sense of the world and bring pieces together. And like most Americans, I've lived most of my life with almost no knowledge of Islam. Almost none. And growing up, the only information I received about Islam was taught by evangelicals who warned us to fear that religion. And most of the people who warned me about Islam had likely never even read the Quran, nor known a Muslim, other than in a debate or in some kind of way of diminishing the other person. See, Islam, like all religions, has a very strict fundamentalist arm. And that arm of their faith gets all of the negative press, right? We see the horrors on the news of what Islamic fundamentalists do, ISIS, and that is part of that arm. It's ugly, it's horrible, but folks, it's not worse than any other religion on the planet in their fundamentalist arm. Now, you might say, well, a modern-day Christian fundamentalist isn't beheading people. That's true, but that wasn't always true. Remember the Crusades? And so, as a result, most Americans have a very deep fear of Islam, which is partly understandable and partly out of ignorance. We just don't know enough about it. And so Islam, like Judaism, is a monotheistic religion that traces its history back to Abraham. And if you're not familiar with the story, I'm going to set this all up. It's going to take some time. This is not going to be one of my shorter podcasts. But you need to hear the pieces so that you can see the trajectory. It's going to change your worldview if you can hear it and see it. Now, if you're not familiar with the story, Abraham's wife, Sarai, at the time, which later was changed to Sarah, so Abram's wife, Sarai, was barren. She couldn't have kids, and in desperation, she gave her maidservant, Hagar, to Abraham as a wife in order to bring forth children. This was a common practice, but it was kind of like you didn't really want to have to do that. You wanted to have your own children. Nonetheless, the firstborn child to Abraham was Ishmael through Hagar. Now, in Middle Eastern culture, the older brother is the blessed child, the oldest son. And they receive the larger share of the family's wealth and inheritance. But beyond that, it's the older child that is typically given the blessing of the father. This blessing is the favor of God passed on from one generation to the next. It's really a very big deal. So an important note here is that in the Hebrew scripture of Genesis, which is also upheld in Islam, even though some of it differs a little bit in the Quran, the lineage of the patriarchs actually in Hebrew scripture completely subverts this tradition of blessing the oldest son. What you see in each generation of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph is that it's the youngest son that each receive the blessing of God from their father, much to the chagrin of the older brothers. It's subtle, but it's a subversive message to those who put too much weight in their tradition and their structure. I mean, God is saying, I will bless who I choose, not who you choose. So in this story later, when Sarah, formerly known as Sarai, she becomes pregnant as promised by God to Abraham. She gives birth to Abraham's second son, Isaac. Now, it's a tale of two lineages, folks. One which is the tradition and the flesh through Hagar, and one which is untraditional and a part of the promise through Sarah. Now, the New Testament talks about this in Galatians chapter 4, verses 21 through 41. Now, prior to Sarah being with child, she was so jealous of Hagar being pregnant and having a child, having Ishmael, that it created huge tensions in the family. And at the time, her name was Sarai, and she ends up sending Hagar away to die in the desert. And out in the desert, the angel of God speaks to Hagar and tells her to return and submit. It's vital. This is a vital piece. Return and submit. And why is that vital? Because the name Islam means complete submission, right? So she's told to go and submit to the family again, to Abraham. And so the angel prophesies to Hagar and says, "Behold, you are pregnant, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael," which means God will hear. Ishmael means God will hear. "And you shall call his name Ishmael because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he shall dwell over and against all kinsmen." So that was the message. That's a proclamation of perhaps a blessing. And what you see then is Hagar receives this proclamation, and Ishmael is raised as the firstborn of Abram, the older brother. You see, later, God establishes a covenant with Abram, changing his name to Abraham, and promises a child through Sarai, now called Sarah. So when God establishes a change, he kind of changes the name. You'll see that in a lot of these stories. Now this child becomes Isaac, who fathers Jacob. And if you know the story, Jacob is renamed Israel. So now you can see the two lineages, right? I mean, if we miss this tale of these two lineages, we miss the vital lens through which to view Islam. The story continues and proves that God is blessing and prospering both tribes. In fact, they grow and interact with each other and eventually war with each other, not only through scripture, but they continue to war with each other to this very day. And where do they war the most? Well, if you're thinking over, if they're warring over Israel, like who is rightfully entitled to Israel, then you have the sense, right? Because the contention today is the same as it was then. Who is the rightful heir to the promised land? Do you see it? Now, if you can understand these two lineages, Judaism and Islam, coming from the same father, one is a child of the flesh, one is a child of the promise, right? One is a tradition, one goes untraditional. Now, once we see this aspect, we begin to appreciate the rise of Islam with Muhammad coming on board later in like the mid-500s, okay? He establishes the Quran as the holy book, which will restore Islam back to the original faith of Abraham, Moses, and Jesus. Now think about this. Now, I find this to be extremely interesting. And this is why last week I taught Judaism as archetype. Now, if you didn't listen to that, go back and hear it. It's really important that we see the true faith of Abram prior to Judaism and acknowledge that something existed there with Abram. Something existed there. And Islam is teaching that Muhammad was the conduit of God's revelation in the Quran. So true Islam, true total submission, tries to follow the life and teachings of Muhammad revealed in the Quran known as the Sunnah. In the same way that Abraham existed prior to Judaism, so Muhammad existed prior to Islam. Islam is and has always been about complete submission. The question is to what? And this is where I think modern Islam is seeking self-criticism. It's seeking freedom to explore changes, But within Islamic culture and in Islamic states, there isn't the freedom to ask questions, to make changes, to alter the course of the religion. So oftentimes they have to move to other countries where freedom of religion and freedom of expression are there so that they can go into new envoys of what Islam can look like. And they can benefit from the self-criticism that hundreds and hundreds of years of Judaism and Christianity have benefited from. See, Islam is and has always been about complete submission. Like I said, the question is to what? Now, most explorations of religion focus on the differences in the never-ending game of my God can beat up your God. I mean, each religion has apologists who defend their faith. But in actuality, they're really just defending the religion, the tradition, the framework of belief, or the doctrine. Yeah, I used to get caught up in that myself. I loved it. But I can't do it anymore. And my approach is different now. Knowing how futile those discussions are, I would rather we try and see what is bubbling up through it all. You see, modern Islam is in love with its mosques, its imams, and its power plays. In precisely the same way modern Judaism is in love with its temples and priests, and Christianity is in love with its churches and pastors. It's all about the containers and less about the contents. Now, that's not always true, right? You know individuals who are deeply devout and could care less about the contents and have a deep heart for the container. And if that's the truth for you, it's the truth in all of these religions, because none of the founders could ever have followed the religion, right? What were they following? This is the point. Was Muhammad trying to wake people up after centuries of tradition of, you know, just doing religion? If he were here today, would he try and do the same for modern day Muslims? Would he say, look, you guys, I get the five pillars are helpful. I'm not here to take those down. I don't want to get rid of the religion. But the total submission is it's not so much to the five pillars. Those are tools to help you get to the heart of total submission, complete submission, which is to God, right? Or would he just say, no, total submission to God is only seen in total submission to the rules in the church and the mosques and the synagogue and the rules and the law, right? We see this in Judaism. We see it in Christianity. We see this in all of the religions. Fundamentalism creeps in and makes its ugly head because it empowers people to leverage power over others. And I've read through the Quran only about 3 or 4 times. And like reading the Old Testament, the Quran has a flow not unlike the Psalms, because it's meant to be sung or chanted. It has a similar rhythm as Proverbs, where the themes kind of phase in and phase out over a few verses at a time, and then they kind of return upon themselves. There are portions where the praise elevates the soul, as well as the fear of offending Allah pits us against ourselves and our world. And again, it's pointless to kind of approach other faith systems with a my God can beat up your God disposition. That is otherness disease. That is the epitome of a binary framework. See, I've heard evangelicals say that in Islam, Allah is not a friend of the sinner, whereas in the Hebrew scripture, Yahweh is compassionate to the sinner. But of course, that ultimately depends on which passages we are reading. Yahweh is happy to bring destruction on sinners, just like Allah. And there are pages, in fact, every verse of every chapter, I should say, of the Quran begins with God, the most merciful, the most beneficent. So there's something to be said here and when describing the ideas of God. To argue that these systems of faith are trying to describe two different gods is to fall prey to the trap of our own fundamentalism from the camp or team that we've grown up in. So remember, Abraham's faith is the basis of every system. This is why it's the archetype. It is for the Jew, it's the same for the Muslim, and it is certainly for the Christian. This faith existed before any of these religions did. So if Muhammad is trying to return everybody to true Islam, then it has to be returning us far back as the faith where it existed prior to the religions. See, Muhammad was trying to create a structure that would bring people back to this same faith. And that's the same thing that Judaism ultimately did. But along the way, each tradition ratified itself and created factions, distinctions, and ultimate hostility by focusing on the container and not the contents. And see, for me, I wonder, the most devout Muslim is not the fundamentalist, but those seeking the freedom to practice their faith as the original faith that pre-existed all religions. The one who's trying to go back and sort it out and find the purity of this. This effort in systems of faith is happening in all systems of faith. You see Christians trying desperately to return to the faith of the early church, to represent in the biggest, clearest picture, what was Christ truly believing and how did he live? And can we go back and live that way? You see that in Judaism. So yeah, it's the same in Islam too. But on the surface level, following the five pillars of Islam is following the teaching of Muhammad. So for most people, they just go along that way. But that's no different than any other religion. However, if the true goal of Muhammad was to get back to the true faith, then those who would return may have to bravely break away from those who see such pursuits as falling away. Now, this is really interesting. You see, because if you're seeking that self-criticism of your faith, if you're trying to find that thing that existed before the religion, then you have to step away in some way spiritually from the religious practice. And when you do, socially, politically, economically, those who are in the practice are going to see you as deficient, as falling away, as losing yourself, losing your life, being corrupted. And in Islam, that means you will be ostracized. It means you'll be broken off from the family. And so in order to do that, you'd have to be extremely courageous, much like departing from fundamentalist Mormonism or any other fundamentalist tradition. You see, this is precisely what Abram would have experienced when he turned away from his kindred and his land to follow this voice of God. See, the passage from the Quran seems to point in this direction. Listen to this. It's from Al-Baqarah 63. It says, "Surely the believers and the Jews and the Christians and the Sabaeans, whichever party from among these truly believes in Allah on the last day and does good deeds, shall have their reward with the Lord, and no fear shall come upon them, nor shall they grieve." So he's getting at it. There's a lot of religious faiths. He's describing different faith systems, but they're saying the believers, the true believers, get beyond that. And if they can get there and they can believe in God, they shall not grieve, right? He's getting at it, I think. Now, I've come to trust sacred text more than those who teach it, and especially those who teach it from their respective positions of power, profit, and politics. I mean, this series is going to reveal how religion has value, but each falls short and has the potential of corrupting the true faith by forcing compliance with threat and fear and intimidation and harm. Those are horrors. Those are oppressive horrors on humanity in the name of religion. This is why most atheists exist. See, each religion uses their texts to oppress humanity and bring about the ends of the religion. And when this happens, that which the founder experienced and hoped to share is lost. It's lost in the tradition. It's lost in the religious power plays. It's completely disconnected from the experience of the founder. And most religions don't even care. See, the true believer is him or her who completely submits to God, who surrenders all the outcomes, who trusts in their maker above all else. This is true for all religions. I can think of Buddhists, Hindus, Sikhs, Muslims, Jews, and Christians who all get to this place of complete submission. So this is what Islam was and is still trying to say. Though now, I think so much of what it's being say is being obscured by the religion itself, just like in every religion. It says in the Quran, it says, surely the true religion with Allah is Islam, or complete submission. So the true faith is complete submission. Can you hear that? I can. I see it everywhere. Now, if you read this, and because I'm even reading out of the Quran, you're somehow offended, your defenses are up, then you are probably too over-identified with your competing religious system. And you're missing the faith that comes through complete submission. If you're a Muslim and you read this or hear this and you conclude that the true religion is only about practicing the five pillars and not submission on the level of the heart, then you too may be over-identified with your religious practice and missing the essence of your own prophet's teaching. It's a mistake every person of faith makes within every single religion. So, the question for all of us is this: do we submit to the tradition and religious practices, or do we submit to the voice of God, which may call us sometimes deeper into the religion and its practices, or sometimes calls us out of them? Which is more vital to life and spiritual progress, the obedience to the flesh and tradition, or obedience to the promise and the call of God? Will the Jew return to the faith of Abram? Will the Muslim follow Muhammad's call to the return to the faith of Abram, which started it all? You see, both monotheistic religions have become the older brother, enrobed in external displays, which can mask over an insincere heart. And that is true in Christianity, Islam, Judaism, in every world religion. But God sees us. God sees the heart, each of us. And it's up to each of us to follow in Abram's footsteps. We follow in Abram's footsteps when we leave our kindred, when we go away from the familiarity, when we leave our tradition and into the land that God is going to show us. That is what faith is. It's trusting that inner voice that's calling us out. The New Testament, it's Lazarus, come forth, awaken. This is very hard to do from within religious frameworks, like I said, because when you do, you become penalized as a dissenter. Now, when we're able to follow the voice, the message, the call, the faith that we share among us is actually the exact same faith. It's found within each religion, but it is not the religious practice. It's beyond it. It's a faith that subverts every claim upon our lives and our being, because only God can determine who we really are. This is the true faith. This is complete submission. See, it's a path of liberation. It's a path of submission to the main thing. It's a path of authenticity. It's the faith of Abram. It's the call of Muhammad. And as we will see, it's the message of the gospel.